Yeah, I discovered last week, Craig, you're a little bit more softly spoken than I gave you credit for.
Oh, right.
I had to bump you up quite high in the mix.
I think I am quite softly spoken.
You had a letter from Sue Mercer and it was like this. Got one from Sue Mercer. I was like, oh, I've got to bump that up in the mix.
Oh, I've got one from Sue Mercer.
barely hear you. Anyway.
Right.
Should we get on with it?
Yeah. Should we do it?
Yeah.
Right.
So, clean tune.
This is the Living Spit Podcast. Welcome to the Living Spit Podcast. Listen to the Living Spit Podcast. It's on the way.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
I flew in the face of convention and did a short, sharp hello.
I know. And then I rode on your metaphorically on your back.
Yeah. And then I woke up because I was asleep.
Well, hello.
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 This is it. This is the Living Spit Podcast. We're back.
We
ladies
are.
And gents, L's and G's. I'm going to get this in. L's and G's. And we're back at the theatre shop bar, appropriately socially distanced.
We are. We're about, what, 10 feet away from each other?
At least 10 feet, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig Edwards is here as well, again.
Hello!
There he is.
Yeah.
How you doing, Craig?
I'm doing good.
What have you been up to this week?
I'm painting the front of my house.
Whoa.
I'm up a very, very long ladder, and I'm being very safe.
You be careful, because
I
love you both as a friend and as a meal ticket.
Thank you.
Great.
Well, hello and welcome again, as Howard said, to the Living Spit Podcast. Here we are again, the three of us. If you're enjoying this podcast, and we hope that you are.
There are certainly definitely one or two people that are.
I've worked out we've got about a core fan base of about 76 people.
Is that right?
I think it's about 76 consistent downloaders.
That's
of this
pretty
podcast.
Good.
Yeah, it's
and,
not bad, is
and
it?
And people, who was it? Rod and Jack. Hello
they've been
to
listening.
Rod and Jack.
Hi, Rod and hi, Jack.
And also, I'm going to say a special hello as well to my friend Alex in Gormal, who rang me the other day to say she'd finally, she's not very good with technology, she'd be the first to admit it, finally found the podcast and started listening to it, and she listened to the third one, I think, which was One Man and His Cow.
Oh, right.
And she said she had to pull the car over because she was laughing so much at the story of me falling in a box.
It's a classic story, Alex. I'm glad you enjoy it. Yeah, hi, Alex, and hi, all of those people, Rod and Jan. And thanks to anyone who's listening to this now. We still can't believe it.
No.
But if you are enjoying it, and we hope that you are, please remember, if you can, to give generously to our GoFundMe account as well. That just
and
helps
you've, this week you've learnt it off by heart, haven't you?
The link, no, we still haven't. No. The link of it will be on under the podcast when we post it up on Facebook. So please click on that and give what you can.
And I should say, I did just the website this week.
I saw that. Yeah.
So you can now get the podcast direct from the website, which is livingspit.co.uk.
Wow, how was that a difficult process?
Oh, it was honestly there were so many lines of code and things that I had to write. No, not at all.
I thought you were going to say lines of coke. Then I went through so many lines of coke doing it.
I don't take drugs.
Honestly, I was
unlike
climbing the walls.
Some people I could mention.
He's looking with his big eyes at us two. I don't know
but neither
what he's
of which
got
I've got
us.
No evidence about.
He seems to have something on us, Craig, that we don't know about even. So anyway, enough of this bants.
You say that. We haven't got much content this week. It might be all bants.
Well, we'll see. We're on to Frankenstein Part 3. I can't believe we've stretched this into three episodes.
Oh, I can't believe it.
Well, today we're going to be talking about the fact that we made a theatre in an old warehouse on Western Seafront, which was formerly a dilapidated swimming pool, the Tropicana. We made it into a theatre, didn't we, boys?
We did.
And we did.
And very nice it was. Well, it wasn't. It was sort of a bit shit, wasn't it?
It was, but
that was
quite,
kind of the that was the vibe we were going for, so,
absolutely.
So that's good.
What else have we got coming up in this episode, Howard?
We've got an interview with Tom Knott.
Have we or not?
Brilliant. Our guitar and trumpet player from the Frankenstein Band. Over the last couple of weeks, we've heard from Lauren and Mike and also Gareth, who's the artistic director. You know all this. You've been listening to it.
Of course you are.
But this week, we've got Notty, our guitarist, who had never been in a theatre show before doing this.
No.
But we talked to him about
we
that.
We talked about that in the interview. Yeah, so stay tuned for that. But first, let's have some comments from last week's show.
Yeah, I love the comments. It's my favourite bit.
Right.
Okay, this is from Sue Mercer. Hi, guys. Really, really chuffed to be mentioned in your Facebook comments. Did you know that a Frankenstein museum is going to be created in Bath, where Mary Shelley probably wrote the novel?
Wow.
I think it's widely known that she wrote the novel on the shores of Lake Geneva in a big house.
That's right,
With
maybe she finished it off in
maybe
Bath.
Maybe she did, yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be sited in a house house on Gay Street. I asked Fiona if she remembered having Stu's head on her desk. She obviously had a friend of Fiona.
Yeah.
Stu's head on her desk, and she said it was gruesome.
Well, she kept it on her desk
for long
enough.
To be honest, Sue, we think that every day. We look at Stu's head and we go, it is gruesome.
This is what I have to put up with, listeners, every week.
I was particularly impressed with Stu's Cockney impression last week.
That's more like it, Sue.
As I am a Londoner and have only been in Bristol for 14 years. So, a nostalgic moment.
That was when I was doing the impression of Michael Vail.
Michael Vail!
I'm a designer!
I read that they were trying to get hold of a first edition signed copy of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein for that museum, but they couldn't afford it. And guess how much one is?
Oh, this is brilliant. Guess. Do we get to guess.
Wow.
Right, a first edition signed copy, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. What do you reckon?
The trouble is with guesses like this, right? Yeah. What you don't want to do is go in too high and then it's a massive disappointment when
That's true.
So you have to be a bit careful, because if I went in and said £73 million,
yes, I think I'm going to say it's less than £73 million. I'll tell you that.
So I'm going to go for, and I hope this isn't too high, I'm going to go for $500,000.
Okay, Craig, any advance?
Yeah, I reckon closer to $1 million. So I'm going to go $900,000.
Yeah, so you've both done exactly what Howard described.
Oh, no!
Going too high. It's actually 350,000.
Right, there's still a
substantial sum. So you're not far off.
Yeah,
you're not far off with
$500,000 from that.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to buy one from my museum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose for a museum exhibit about writing Frankenstein,
yeah,
it's going to be the kind of key exhibit, isn't it? Yeah.
And also in the article I read about this museum, thanks for bringing our attention to it, by the way, Sue, it's very interesting. The people who are opening this museum are buying most of the stuff from it on eBay.
Brilliant.
Just all the like monstery things.
But that's my sort of museum, I'm going to say. I mean, you know, we went to the British Museum when we were in London doing Henry, and it was brilliant.
It was.
But there was a lot, you do get a bit kind of museum fatigue, don't you? You go, oh, yeah, there's another
sarcophagus. Brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, how many mummies can we see?
The first couple are brilliant, and then it's like, oh, there's another one. Oh, another mummy.
Oh, the Rosetta Stone. Oh, brilliant. You do get a bit sort of desensitized to the brilliance of it, don't you? Because there's so many brilliant things in that museum.
Yeah.
And the gift shop's wonderful. So, there you go.
I'll do this one.
Go on in.
This is from top fan David Phillips. I know I've said this before, but great podcast again, and has made me want to see Frankenstein even more.
Thanks, David.
Even Stu's penis has not put me off.
Brilliant.
Oh, okay. Also, a great honour to have Craig read out my comments. Well, there you go. Done with a certain panache.
Something like that.
I try my best. A bit worried about Stu's new spot. Should a man who gets his penis out at the drop of a hat be advising the vulnerable in society?
It's a good point.
It is a good point.
I don't think you do get your penis out at the drop of a hat.
No, not that. No. Not a hat.
You get your penis out when the script requires you
That's
to.
That's true.
Can
it's
we
not
just talk
the drop
about
of a hat.
It? Yeah. It's something that I've wanted to talk about.
Is it my penis again? Because we mentioned that quite a lot last week.
No, not really. It's Craig's pronunciation of the word penis.
Penis.
Like, but
penis.
Everybody says penis, don't they?
Yeah,
we?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, I had a book called Where Did I Come From?
Right.
And it was about sex, you know, what happens in sex.
The stork for kids. Bringing like, you in the bundle.
No, yeah, it was proper, you know, it was like all the kind of stuff about sperm and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it said, these are called breasts, for instance, and then it said some people call them boobs or bristles, but they're known as breasts. It was brilliant. Yeah. But the description of, and this is the penis, it's like peanuts without the T. So that's all how I've always thought of penis.
Yeah.
And so when I hear Craig say penis, it just sounds wrong.
Yeah, but you haven't heard him say peanuts. He goes, pass me those peanuts.
What, have you got some?
What?
Peanuts.
There we go. Brilliant. Okay, thank you, David. That's
a lovely
point. But penis. I don't drop my penis at the drop of a hat.
Penis. Penis.
Yeah. And Craig's still working
Craig's
on his
still
pronunciation
just saying penis
of penis.
Now.
PJ Naylor's come in. Now, I think this is directed towards Howard and his French jokes.
Yeah.
I'm going to attempt to pronounce it. He says, Légionnaires de la Baie ou Légionneux de la Baie?
So I think I'm not quite sure what Légionnaire de la Baie means. I mean, the direct translation, as you've very kindly
I've
put,
kindly
is Father's Legionnaires.
Yes.
A father as in the father of an abbey, you know.
Oh, that, like
that
a monk.
Sort of thing. I think basically Légionnaire de la Baie is also It sounds, in French, it's a homonym.
Yes.
So it sounds like Les Genoux de la Baie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the bee's knees. Presumably, Les Genoux de la Baie are some kind of insult. Because right. our living spit, the Légionnaire de la Baie.
I see.
Or Les Genoux de la Baie.
Are they shit or are they the best thing ever,
basically? I'm guessing. If it's not that, then Pip, if you can come over.
Well,
and,
it's quite highbrow for us,
it is,
Pip.
Yeah, even me. And
even
I speak
Howard.
A bit of French.
Yeah, but it's very good. Thanks, Pip.
Okay, this is from Milky Sadler, our lovely Mike Slater from the band. Another wonderful accompaniment to a lockdown walk. Can't wait for next week's with Tom Knott. Ever since he was first mentioned, I was waiting for the is he or not, etc. And laughed out loud when Stu finally delivered. What do you mean, finally delivered?
Well, I did leave it late. I left it quite late, and I was quite subtle with it. Yeah. Thanks, Milky.
A slight bone to pick. Your jingles are brilliant, and one of my fave parts, although you do need to change the lyrics for the end jingle.
Yeah, I'm in agreement here.
Well, do you know what, Craig? I'm in agreement, and it's been something that I've been thinking about for a while. And when Milky put it...
It ruins the whole podcast for me.
Well, you're in luck, because this week... Yeah. We've only gone and recorded a new version of the jingle, haven't we? Yeah,
but Milky, you're going to have to wait till the end to hear it.
Sorry about taking up so many comments. I keep pressing send by accident. Can't seem to delete the posts. Feel free to delete them and delete the idea if you think it's shit. Can't be bothered. Big love, XXX.
I've got
a feeling the last bit wasn't intended for broadcast.
No, I don't think any of it was, but we broadcast a lot, so... Well, thanks, Milky. You're going to have to wait till the... You're right there.
No, I'm not. I've got... unfortunately, I've got COVID-19. I haven't...
Right?
I actually had a test this week.
What, a COVID test?
I did. On Thursday. I can't believe this has dropped in the middle of it. I do have a cough every morning. It's just I'm asthmatic, and that's a thing. But it was particularly bad. It wouldn't. So I thought, well, you know, I've got to do the right thing here. I've got to go and have a test and make sure that I'm okay.
Or get in a car or drive to Durham.
Yes. But instead, I got in a car quite legally and drove to Bristol Airport, where
got on a plane.
No.
Got
that would have been
Brazil.
A story.
Went right here we are.
Well, I've been spreading it all around the world. Yeah. No, I went to Bristol Airport where the testing station is.
Yeah.
And I drove up, and it was all very efficient. I have to say.
Was it?
It was very good.
You got tested inside your car.
Yeah, it's mad. You have to basically nobody. You don't roll your windows down at all, and they talk to you through the windows. Mm. And sometimes they just put a sign up at the window saying "Do this," and it's a bit it's a bit scary. And then when you finally have the test, you do roll down the window.
Right.
And they come and they're kind of in full hazmat suits, and they stick a swab up your nose and in the back of your throat, which is not pleasant, but not that unpleasant.
Do they give you results straight away?
Well, this was the amazing thing. No, they say it, within should be 48, but or within 72. And I was about to go the following day. I was about to, because I felt fine. I was about to go out to the tip. I mean, I can't believe I'm putting this on a podcast. I was about to go out to the tip. And I said to my daughter, I said, I'm going to the tip. My wife was on a work call. I said, I'm going to the tip. Oh, no, I can't go to the tip, can I? Because I've got to stay in until I've got the results of this test. So I went upstairs. And at that exact moment, a text came through telling me I was COVID-free.
Whoa.
So I did go to the tip.
You did go to the tip.
Do you want to hear about what the tip was like?
I think let's put a... That was a lovely excerpt from your autobiography there. you're listening to Radio 4. No, we'll move on. But that was very good, very interesting. Anyway, so those are the comments. Thanks, Milky. Wait to the end, and you can hear your new jingle. Well, it's not yours.
We haven't used your lyrics, Milky.
We haven't used your lyrics, but we've used similar ones.
Yeah.
So check it out. But let's crack on with this podcast, shall we? And we're talking this week about not so much the birth of the mirth as the birth of a theatre. Because we're talking about the Tropicana.
So have you done a new jingle, The Birth of the Theatre?
I haven't done it. That's The Birth of the Theatre. No, I haven't. We'll just do The Birth of the Mirth one.
Okay.
Here it is.
People ask us, where'd you get your ideas? Well, let us tell you lots of blood, sweat and tears. And now we'll tell you how we maintain these careers. For what it's worth, it's The Birth of the Mirth.
Okay, so I've written a little potted history of the Tropicana. Just for a little bit of background.
It's like having Simon Sharma here.
Okay, so I'll just run through it quite quickly. So, 1937, the pool opens its doors to the public for the first time.
I should say, that's in inverted commas.
It
is. It was obviously called The Pool.
The Pool. It must not have been called the Tropicana at that point then. Anyway, the pool opens its doors to the public for the first time following a £60,000 project, giving Weston-super-Mare its very own outdoor swimming pool. At 950 square metres, it was the largest open-air swimming pool in Europe and included an Art Deco diving board. Wow. I never saw that Art Deco dining room. No. I don't think it was there in the 80s when I went.
No, I don't think it was.
Anyway, I'll move on. 1947, Hollywood film stars Laurel and Hardy visit to be guest judges at the town's Modern Venus Beauty competition. There we go. And on a side note, it was won by Beryl Smith and Diana Dawes came third. Although by that, at that time she was called by her real name, Diana Fluck.
Yeah, you'd change it, wouldn't you?
yeah, you
would. Because she was local, wasn't she?
She was from Swindon. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Diana Dawes. Basically, if you're under 50 and listening to this, you won't have a clue we're talking about.
That's true, yeah. I mean, it's not likely that under 50s are listening to this, is it?
It's a fair point, it's a fair point.
yeah, and I found this little story. This is from Diana Dawes' autobiography.
Right, I love it.
According to Diana Dawes' autobiography, she was once asked and readily agreed to open a fete in her hometown of Swindon. Prior to the festivities, Dawes lunched with the local vicar, during which she informed him that her real name was Diana Fluck. The vicar became somewhat worried about his planned speech. After lunch, they arrived at the fete at the appointed time. The vicar, totally unnerved about mispronouncing Fluck, introduced Dawes with these immortal words. Ladies and gentlemen, it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you our star guest. We all love her, especially as she is our local girl. I therefore feel it right to introduce her by her real name. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the very lovely Miss Diana Clunt. A true story, apparently.
That is brilliant.
That is a great story, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Well, there we go.
In 1982, and this is when I remember it anyway, the attraction closes to the public for renovation after Woodspring District Council successfully applied for permission to demolish the then-listed diving board.
Ah, so they got demolished, I
yeah,
see.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and this is the bit I remember quite clearly, following a £1 million redevelopment, the Tropicana Pleasure Beach reopens to the public. The diving boards are replaced by a wave machine, pineapple-shaped water chutes, and a water heater.
I remember
on
it
On its
well.
First day, 7,500 visitors turn up, meaning many had to queue until 6 p.m. to get in. Now, I remember that. I would have been 12 in 1983.
Yes.
And I probably went in the very early days. I remember it being very exciting. There was the pineapple slide.
Oh, that was brilliant.
And you like, water parks are a big thing these days, but it was so amazing, this kind of, like, you know, it was so, you'd never seen the like. Wave machine.
And outdoors as well,
outdoors,
right on the beach.
Yeah,
it was unheard of, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember that pineapple slide and that water chutes and things. That was its kind of heyday for me. And I remember going there once in the 80s, must have been 88 or 9, and there was an infestation of ladybirds.
Oh, wow.
And they were over everyone. I remember seeing a girl I was at school with, Amanda Kapelich, if you're asking, and I said, oh, Amanda. She turned around, her face covered in ladybirds. I remember thinking that was really freaky.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of me standing in the big fountains. You know the big fountains as you come down to the front?
Yeah.
There's a big circular fountain, isn't there?
I remember that.
There's a picture of me standing in them as a kid.
Oh, well, you're from the Midlands, so you would have gone to
We were
Western,
always going down to the southwest from the, well,
for yeah, holidays and things.
For holidays and stuff. And I think that was probably in the early 70s.
Wow.
So we must have gone to the Tropicana and jumped off the Art Deco diving boards.
Yeah. I expect you did.
Anyway, back to 1997. The Tropicana celebrates its 60th birthday with a spectacular party opened by the comedian Eddie Large.
Yes. Sadly, no longer with us.
Yeah. Mm. Birthday cards were sent by local celebrities Jill Dando and...
No longer with us.
Jeffrey Archer.
Sadly, still with us.
We all thought the same joke.
Yeah, there you go.
Carry on, Craig. Go
1999.
Yeah.
Signs of strain emerge as it only opened for 7 weeks during the summer and made a £16,000 loss.
Now, this is the beginning of the end, isn't it, for the Tropicana?
Well, carry on, Stu.
Okay, in 2000, North Somerset Council spent £70,000 ensuring it reaches health and safety standards, but after just 6 weeks, it shuts again, recording a loss of £38,000 for the year. Howard's weeping now just at this. The Tropicana reluctantly closes its doors as a swimming pool for the very last time. It's all right, Howard. It's all right. It has a happy ending.
Kind of. Yeah, kind of.
And then summer 2015, Dismal Land Bemusement Park, an art installation curated by the world-famous street artist Banksy, opens at the Tropicana for just 5 weeks. The, quote, sinister twist on Disneyland, unquote, features original works by Banksy and 58 other artists, including Damien Hirst, and attracts over 150,000 visitors from all over the world, generating $20 million in revenue. Now, I remember trying to get a ticket for this, and I couldn't.
No.
Anyway, Dismaland also features outdoor musical performances by global superstars, including Damon Albarn, De La Soul, and Pussy Riot.
De La Soul? I mean, Damon Albarn, yeah, I mean, great, you know, gotta love him. Yeah. Pussy Riot, get it, but, you know, not my thing. But De La Soul, in Western?
Yeah.
Come on.
And it wasn't the first Pussy Riot that Western Supermare had, was it?
No, because there was that, all those stray cats, wasn't there?
Yeah.
That kicked off on
They just kicked off.
Yeah.
And more it was whiskers.
All, yeah,
more kitty cat.
That's it, yeah. They had to call in the police dogs.
Hey!
You'd see,
so. Oh, this is brilliant. And then cut to November 2016. We turned up.
Nice.
Yeah, see what it did there? We turned up.
So doing it at the Tropicana was quite a big deal for our Arts Council application, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Because, well, Western was very keen on the whole cultural thing since Dismaland.
Well, I think they'd realised that the arts could generate revenue.
Absolutely.
And they were quite keen to kind of see what they could do with the building.
Mm.
And we were sort of doing our thing. And Fiona Matthews was both working with us and with Theatre Orchard, who were the kind of... doing a lot of work in Western Supermare. So it's sort of all, it was a perfect storm, really, wasn't it? And we saw it and we thought, you know.
Where did the idea come from? Was it our idea?
Yeah, I think it was. I think without wanting to be, I think it might have been my idea.
There we go.
I think I had a conversation with Fiona and she said, you know, they're looking to put things in there. And I think I said, well, we're doing Frankenstein. Why don't we just take Frankenstein there?
Mm.
And as Fiona would do, that was the end of my involvement with the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
She kind of just take it off and do it. Mm. So which that's what happened with the theatre shop as well. But yeah, so I think that's what happened. That's my recollection anyway. Mm. And I remember going round really early on,
didn't we?
We had a meeting, a site meeting.
That's right.
I mean, virtually derelict at the time. They were putting the power in at the time.
But they were also dismantling Dismaland as well.
Yes.
Because when we got there was heavy security.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going, what's all this about? And it was literally because they were packing away the artwork.
Millions of pounds of
millions
artwork.
And you were going, oh my God, so that bit of cardboard on the floor there, is that a Banksy?
Yeah. I could
just pick that up. And you thought, no, I can't, because the security guys are looking at me we know what you're thinking, matey.
Yeah.
That bit of cardboard is worth £85 million.
Yes. No, that bit of cardboard wasn't. That was just a
was
bit
it,
of cardboard.
Was it just a bit of cardboard?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there were bits of cardboard.
There were bits of cardboard.
Yeah.
So we had a site meeting, didn't we? And we kind of had, you know, that'd be good. And we should explain, if you haven't been there, although it's an outdoor swimming pool, there is a huge indoor space, isn't there?
Yes.
Which in my day was a kind of, was an ice skating rink, I think.
Was it?
Yeah.
But back in the day, that used to be the kind of changing area,
I think so.
Wasn't
and
it?
I think there were like amusements and stuff like that in there.
There's a big warehouse. So basically, the way it looks now is that the whole of the pool has been filled in with concrete. I think the pineapple is—it's not there anymore. But there's a mural on the back wall, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Yeah,
which is a kind of mosaic tile of a kind of lovely summer's day. And then you go into the building itself, and there's now a bar in there, which used to be like the changing room or the reception-y room, or like you said, the amusements. And then you go down into these kind of warehouses, this huge, big, long bit.
Fairly narrow, isn't it?
It's not fairly narrow. Yeah, well, we came into problems, didn't we, because it was so narrow, because we were trying to give ourselves more wing space.
Yes, that's right.
And we couldn't, because it wasn't enough room.
Mm.
I remember that one morning, we got really early, we turned up, didn't we, and they made us wear our yellow high-vis vests.
And a hat.
And
safety
our hard
helmets.
Hats.
Yeah.
And we went and checked it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember just going, yeah, it's just a big warehouse.
Mm.
It wasn't anywhere near to being a theatre. But this was like a year and a half before we did the show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, we'd done The Devil and the Shopkeeper, and we just walked into an empty shop lot and gone, we can do a show here.
I think it probably turned out much more high-tech than I thought it would. But that was a big part of our, as I say, of our Arts Council grant, that we were going to do the show in Salisbury, and then we're going to take it to West and build this theatre. And that was... Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? Getting a theatre built.
It was.
Especially given that most of it happened when we were sort of in rehearsals and stuff. So we weren't that involved in that, were we? I mean,
Not really. We met Bob. Do you remember Bob?
Well, we took Bob on. Bob Holmes, brilliant. What's he? Production manager.
Production manager, he's a production manager.
Yeah, brilliant production manager who'd done a lot of site-specific things. So he'd worked with Knee-High, hadn't he?
Had he? I hadn't met him.
I think he worked with Knee-High.
Shall we explain what a production manager
does?
Yes,
we should. Yes,
well,
please.
What a production manager is, usually in a building, like in a theatre, when a show is put together, the production manager will manage the budget. So he or she will go, well, this is how much money we've got, and this is how much money we're going to give to all the different departments. So every week there'll be a production meeting where people come together and go, yeah, we've spent this much on these hats. And the production manager will go, yep, you spent too much. That's not what we agreed. So yeah. That's what the production manager... So there are people who are very technically minded because they'll understand how things are made and how much they cost and where the best places to get those things made. And they're also very good with money because they'll understand, you know, how much things cost and how people manage their money and get money to them. So they're really, really an integral part of how shows are made. And I guess for us, it was like, we're making a theatre here, so we need to get a lighting rig in, we need to get seats in, we need to make it safe for the public to come in, we need to get loos, we need to get electricians in. So he, you know, he was a perfect guy to have.
Yeah.
And he was incredibly experienced, and he knew lots of people. Yeah. He'd go, oh, yeah, we can get that done. Oh, yeah, we can get these. He was brilliant, wasn't it?
I remember, we talked last week about production meetings, and I remember it being really exciting being in the production meetings in Salisbury, and we were talking about the Western thing
because
you know, it was all part of the same thing. And I remember having a long thing about seats and which sort of seats that we wanted. Did we want the really comfortable ones, or did we want the really crap ones,
Or mid range
in between? And it's like that costs that much, and how many seats can we fit in? And because obviously for us that's a big deal, because the more seats you can get in, the more
money
you can make from each performance.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like rake seating with an aisle, rake seating with access at the back for the audience, or access at the front for the audience, and where the safety rails are going to go.
And, things like disabled access.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, and things that you don't even consider, things like safety railings and... I don't consider anyway.
And heating as well, because it was just there was no heating. It was an empty warehouse, and we're talking about the middle of November we opened there.
Yeah.
And it was bloody freezing.
Wasn't it?
We had these huge, big industrial kind of fans blasting out heat at people.
And I remember they didn't have mains electricity, did they?
No, they didn't.
So we had to hire these huge generators.
That's right.
All of which was, you know, I say we. I mean, we just turned up, didn't we? Did the show? But
it was a big undertaking for somebody, not for us. Yeah, I mean, Bob us. Mostly. but he was brilliant, wasn't he, Bob?
Yeah, he was great.
Do you remember? I remember a truck got stuck on the beach.
Yes,
and it cost us something like £850 to get this truck rescued.
Yeah,
off the sand before the tide came in.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. And am I right in saying when the tide comes in, the sea lashes against the back?
Well, that happened many times in the show. I remember us being backstage in like the interval.
Yeah, well, our dressing room, well, called them dressing
rooms. Well, yeah, the dressing room was just sort of behind the stage, another big hangar that we sort of hung out in. And I remember hearing the wind whipping and the sea smashing against the dressing room wall, thinking, that's going to cave in a minute, we'll be washed out to sea.
Yeah.
It was also really, really cold in back there, because they didn't put heaters backstage for us, it was just for the audience. So, and I was naked, you know, by the interval, as we've discussed at great length last week, I was.
How was your penis?
I don't want to talk any more about my penis this week. I think the general public have heard enough. But yeah, I'd sit back there in a big dressing gown, huddled up. It was really, really cold.
Can I just draw your attention?
Yes, go on.
And I'm not sure whether we're going to tell this story or not.
Go on.
Toilets backstage? Question mark.
Toilets backstage. Did we have any toilets backstage, Howard?
Not strictly.
not officially. We found one, though, didn't we?
We did. I think that's probably
enough. That's enough. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Craig's looking at us like, we'll tell you off air, Craig.
Yeah.
I think the world isn't ready for that story.
Yes, it's not. Yeah.
So, yeah, we built this theatre. It was a 250, 300-seater, I think.
Yeah.
And there were, like you said, Craig, there were some issues because it wasn't as wide as the Salisbury stage. So it was a bit more challenging getting things on and off, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we had some big set pieces, didn't we, in that? Where the hell were we going to put them? That was a big problem.
Didn't they all end up behind the stage?
They did. So we had to, when we brought them on, they came from behind the stage round.
Yeah. I actually didn't see the show at the Tropicana.
Brilliant. Well, there's an admission. There's
I never saw
a surprise.
I never saw it with an audience. I think I saw a run through. I think because I was in a show somewhere else, I had to get get back to Bristol.
I think you did. You were rehearsing
Cinderella.
Cinderella, I think.
Yeah.
At the tobacco factory.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You're forgiven on this occasion.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember the tech being a bit kind of because you were trying to. We'd do tech sessions in the afternoons and evenings, wouldn't we? Because you had to go to rehearsals in the morning.
I think I came in the morning and then I saw a run through in the afternoon and then I had to go. So I never actually got to see it at the Tropicana.
Well, you missed a treat.
Yeah.
It was lovely, apparently. I don't know, I was in it, so I couldn't tell you.
I thought, it's cold here, I'm not going to sit here.
Yeah, I'm sticking
around. It's freezing.
Yeah.
The sea's going to come in a minute and wash us all away. Why would I want to sit here and watch a piece of theatre?
But I do remember there's a big difference in terms of audiences. I mean, not a big difference, but...
I think in many ways it worked better in the Tropicana.
I think so too.
I mean, yeah. it was brilliant at Salisbury, but I think we probably... I think we made probably one jump too many when we did Frankenstein in as much as we went from 100-seaters to 500-seaters, whereas what we needed to do was go from 100-seaters to 250-seaters and then go up to the 500-seaters.
Yes, yeah.
And I think our style and stuff suited the smaller...
Well, also, there was an extra dimension in Western Supermare in that we were doing this show about bringing some dead thing to life.
Yes.
And we'd kind of... metaphorically done the same with a building.
Wow.
Brought this dead theatre into life.
Wow. Was that a segue, or is that just you being clever?
We have actually talked about
this. Yeah, we have, I think that was... I mean, we didn't plan on that being a thing, but I think it occurred to us when we were doing it.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, guys. We had one of those kind of stoned conversations without the drugs. Just going, whoa, guys, it's like we've brought something dead back to life. Whoa. It's like the play... Whoa! and then we went back on.
I do remember it being... We were interrupted a few times in our work by... we couldn't do first performance.
That's
we were going to do on a Friday, but they went, no, you can't do it Friday, it's Carnival Day. Now, anybody who lives around here will understand the significance of Carnival in Western. It's not the same as Carnival in Rio de Janeiro.
No,
But there's a tradition in Somerset that there's a huge Carnival... every year where there are carnival societies that build these huge floats and there are, and I say literally quite advisedly, literally hundreds of them, aren't they? And they all parade past and it takes about 2.5 hours.
Oh, yeah.
It's standing in the freezing cold.
Yeah.
And you can't get into Western Supermare. So you either have to go in like early.
Yeah.
You have to go in at kind of 3 PM and then stay there till it's done.
Yeah.
Or you have to not go in at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did our tech in the afternoon, didn't we?
Yeah.
And then
we stayed.
Everybody stayed and watched
the carnival. We watched the carnival, didn't we? I remember going out in the freezing cold and watching it.
Yeah. And then what happens the night after carnival is a massive firework display.
That's right, yeah.
Now, that did interrupt the show,
didn't it,
more?
Yeah.
Because it's not that far from the pier, and they were big fireworks.
They were.
And they went on and on, didn't they,
I remember.
Yeah. So that's a good time to talk about the local member of our band.
Yes.
Given that we're local, we're Western Supermare.
Absolutely. It's almost a segue.
It was a tenuous one, but it was good. So we did this interview with Tom Knott the week before last, actually.
Yes, a couple of weeks back.
Yeah. And, here it is. So you and I are mates, aren't we? We've been mates for a while. We met via our children, if you see what I mean.
Via our children. Child rearing in Clevedon.
That's right. And when we were first going to do this show, we knew we wanted somebody else to be in it. And we'll be honest, you got the job because of the way you look, not because of the way you play. I'd never heard you play. I knew you were professional, but I didn't know how good you were or even what style you played in.
But what we do know about you, Tom, was that you've been in bands for a long time and you've played the pyramid stage at Glastonbury, and that was enough.
Yeah,
for me.
That got me the gig.
Yeah,
that
got you the gig.
Got me the foot in the door anyway.
Yeah, it certainly did.
It was the pyramid stage and the facial hair, basically. If you didn't see Frankenstein.
That combination is what you crave.
Tom has the most spectacular facial hair of anybody I know. Think Charles I and you'll be close to it. So we were chatting and we said, you were the first person we got on board, actually, weren't you? Wasn't he, Stu?
Yeah, I think so.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, you were. I mean, we were keen to do something together, I think, from the minute we started talking about getting to know each other and talking about music. And you know, likewise, I was there discovering that you had your professional acting career going on, that you'd actually managed to turn into a business of your own.
Yes.
And so that was like highly inspiring to me. Yeah, and then I think you had the idea for the Frankenstein thing and the possibility of blowing it up into something a bit bigger than just the two of you. And then there was, before I knew it, there was an R&D week being talked about, which is research and development.
So how was that? What were you expecting from that, from research and development?
One of the main things I needed to find out was what on earth the process was of putting a show like that together, because I have experience of being in a band and playing gigs in that way, but no experience at all of doing theatrical stuff. So immediately, as soon as we got there and started doing it, I was like, right, this is going to be a hell of a lot of work. Because, you know, there's a lot of detail has to be planned out in putting a show like that together. And from a layman watching shows happen on stage, it just happens so magically. You don't see the cogs moving. And when you're in an R&D where the cogs don't even fit together yet, it's like, whoa, that's a lot of stuff we've got to get going. Coupled with the fact that Stu is a mean guitar player and there was a few guitar parts, I was like, right, okay, that's going to take me out of my comfort zone as well. So it was the sisters and brothers thing. I was I've got to do finger picking.
Yeah, that was quite a lot of finger picking in a kind of folky style. And so that wouldn't be your normal go-to style for guitar playing.
No.
What sort of stuff were you more used to playing?
I like playing rock stuff, but in actual fact, most of my gigging work has been more, you know, atmospheric pop, I suppose you could say, of various sorts. So Clute, that's I Am Clute, they do very sort of straight down the line songs, really interesting lyrics, but the arrangement is quite, you know, it's quite detailed. And my job in that band was usually to be not the main guitarist, because Johnny Bramwell was playing throughout, so I would be doing all the sort of extra sonic kind of stuff. So lots of sound effects and, you know, soundscape type of things. Similar deal with the earlys. But yeah, I mean, I'm more, my natural place is plectrum, electric guitar, rhythm stuff and atmospheric. So yeah, but as luck would have it, I'd been trying to get some finger picking chops up and running when we did that. So I was like, right, okay, brand new, let's do it.
I think we kind of went in and into every box with the music of Frankenstein, didn't we? You know, there was kind of high, there was some really kind of hard rock stuff. There was some high kind of musical stuff. There was, you know, there was all sorts of stuff. So it did require a kind of a big learn really for all of us, I think.
Yeah, it did. The Victor's theme was a full on funk workout, wasn't it? Which I, you know, I play in Traps, which is a local band, and that's a total funk and ska thing. So that stuff felt pretty natural. But yeah, I think it was more the thing that I realized I was going to have to shape up on, really, was that detail of knowing where you are and being involved in the performance the whole way through.
Yeah.
Where in a band you are, but you know, you can just do whatever you like, you know, to a certain extent, as long as you don't get in the singer's way, then you know, it's all good. But I suppose the scale of the project was the main thing that hit me, but also the fun that was, you know, it was great fun that week. And who was there, who was hanging around there? We had Sam with us, didn't we?
Yes, Sam and Howard Sam and I Hill. And Craig were
fantastic.
In the room,
fantastic. And that was probably the first time I'd met Craig properly. And he was boinging around the studio like crazy, and you know, it was all a very creative kind of vibe, if I can say that. So excited. I was very excited and pretty pleased to be where I was.
And just let's just fast forward now to rehearsals. I mean, obviously there was the kind of creative learning curve, you know, learning different styles, guitar styles, and also you play the trumpet too, and you played a lot of trumpet in the show. Obviously you don't come from a theatre background. No. So what was the learning curve on that? Because that fascinates me. Somebody who's, you know, because we take so much for granted in terms of how we speak to each other, what we talk about. I was very aware at the time that we'd say things and I'd go, I need to explain to Tom what that is, because it's a technical term.
Yeah, there was a bit of jargon. There was a bit of jargon that I had to get used to, for sure. And, you know, upstage, downstage and all that business. I mean, it did also feel a bit like a band gig to me, because we were on the platform and we had, you know, we were sort of set up as a band. That was part of the presentation. And I really liked having, you know, we were in there for a long time, weren't we, rehearsing? Mm-hmm. And it gave us real chance. I mean, we had to be, because there was so much stuff to sort out. But, you know, it was really nice to be able to go in every day, play music all day, and get to know Bex and Lauren, and the, you know, the whole, the band really kind of came together in a really lovely way, which I think, you know, is down to you guys picking some great musicians and actors. There was a lot of support for me because all the other band members were all theatre guys, and most of them very, well, as far as I know, all of them excellent actors.
The technical rehearsal, I remember, that was a new one on you, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. That was all day in the proper setup, wasn't it? Was that when we were into the main room? And just running it and running. But I really, really enjoyed all that because, you know, it was, like I say, it was a new thing to me. And it was really just a lovely chance to really finesse a performance of something, which is quite different from the way that, I mean, I think some bands do work like that, but I've, you know, the bands I've been in have always been a bit more casual about that sort of stuff, let's say. So, yeah, so it was, then there was things started cropping up, wasn't there? Like, things like dance routines.
And acting for you as well,
acting,
Tom.
And a lot of singing as well, which I really enjoyed, actually, because...
You did do a lot of singing, didn't you, in this one? Yeah. Was that you out of your comfort zone again, or do you... Mm. I mean, you do a bit in the earlies, don't you?
Yeah, I think the earlies was the first band that I did serious singing in you know, backing vocals, and I've been sort of building up that ever since then, and that was way back in 2005 kind of time. So I did a lot of singing in Clute as well, and I do a lot of singing in Traps, so I was getting into it. But yeah, it was quite a lot more exposed, and I, you know, when you're in a band, you can kind of choose which bits you want to do, whereas in that situation it's very much like, right, you need to do that because someone needs to do that, and so it's like there was a bit more technical pushing going on.
There's quite a lot of that, isn't there, in this process as well. It's, imagine in bands it's much more democratic. If you've got an idea, you can go, how about we do this, and everyone goes, yeah, that's cool, and they go, but in this process it's much more, no, Tom, you do what you're told. Was that frustrating at any point for you, or did you adjust to that quite quickly?
I liked it. I've never been precious about music stuff. I think it's someone's got to come up with the ideas of what everyone does in the room, and yeah, I have no problem at all with being told what to do. And also, it builds you, it progresses you, being asked to do things that are that you haven't done before. Ukulele, for example.
Oh yeah,
I hadn't played any ukulele before that. I haven't played any since, actually. But I did a whole song.
You did get Craig'd as well, didn't you? Funeral scene, the classic. Yeah. It's nice to know that other people have experienced what we experience, which is that thing of being made to do 17 different things at once. So the classic.
I was particularly bad at that.
There was the kind of the opening sequence, which was you singing in four-part harmony whilst doing a kind of weird, to call it a dance is overplaying it, but it was a kind of weird sort of movement thing, carrying a coffin. It was all
straight on. First scene one, act one, scene one.
Yeah.
Boom, here's your note.
But we definitely need to... The one thing we do need to talk about, and I think Stu knows what I'm going to say, is The Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Now, we've mentioned this before, but we wrote in the script that the audience were going to choose who the bride was going to be. And barring one performance, it was you every time, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly was. It was a role I had to make my own.
It really was, yeah. It might have been something to do with the aforementioned facial hair. People just wanted to see you in that costume.
People like a bearded lady. What can you say?
They do. They do. And so how was that for you, playing that part every night but one?
I enjoyed it very much. I really got into it, you know.
Yeah, you got into it a bit too much, didn't you?
I did a few flamboyant deaths, I seem to recall.
You did, yeah.
Every time I would just be like, I wonder if I have no... I absolutely have no benchmark as to what is good or bad for me to do right now. You know, is it funny if I flail around a lot? Is it funny if I just fall to the floor? Or, you know, should I just
It was funny when you did all those things.
Yeah. I was trying to follow you, Stu, but you were strangling me from behind, so it was just me and the audience.
It was me strangling you, wasn't it?
Oh, was it?
It was me strangling you.
I was trying to save you. I was just trying to make sweet love to you.
Yeah.
It was Howard that was trying to kill you.
Night after night. Knocking on my door, scratching at the window.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I do remember rehearsals as well, because as I said, you've got another job, which is a sound engineer,
that
and I remember you having Thursdays off to go and mix Gardener's World.
Which was always written into my contract.
Yeah.
That's right.
On a Thursday, you could go off and mix Gardener's World.
A little day out, a little
so
day
So Monty
pass.
Don.
It was
the meat in the Living Spit sandwich.
I'd forgotten that. Yeah, because that was a sort of a regular gig, and I felt like if I dropped that, then I wouldn't have anything to go back to at the end of all this.
Yeah.
So,
we were paying you good money, so it was
good, pretty reasonable, okay money.
That's actually one of my questions, because you're used to being in a band. You've played the Pyramid Stage, Tom.
Yeah.
You know, you've been around the block. You've made a little bit of money out
much
of your
for that, mate.
Did you not
pay much for that? No.
I was going to ask you because we weren't able to pay you a huge amount for Frankenstein.
There was a lot of factors to me choosing to do that Frankenstein thing, and money was in no way a major part of it, you know. It was, but there was a lot of other factors that, you know, were part of the complete package for me.
What were they? What were those other factors?
Doing something completely different, playing music all the time, hanging out with you guys, getting to know... do you remember the Slinky?
The Slinky.
Oh, God, yes, the Slinky. I do remember. So tell us about the Slinky. So Tom, well, we needed a sound effect, didn't we, for the kind of animation of the
It was
of
entirely
the
my baby from start to in.
It was
ignominious finish. It wasn't brilliant, but it was quite funny.
Tell us about it, Tom.
Tell us about it.
Well, so there is a good sound that you can make from a Slinky, where if you hang it and you knock it with a metal nail or something, it makes this kind of doo, doo, doo sound. And it's been used in countless sci-fi films as a layer in laser guns and stuff. So I thought, oh, cool. I can set that up. If I could set that up live... When the monster comes to life and, you know, the sparks are flying, I could be setting off and it could look kind of cool because it would, you know, be this weird contraption that I'm whacking. And I just thought, yeah, it'll be good. So I told you guys about it and you all kind of looked like, what the what about? You know, I had a little moment to each other like,
yeah, all right, Tom, get a Slinky.
So I went out and bought a Slinky. I spoke to one of the technicians there and I got some kind of little microphone that I could attach to it, and I got it all ready and sent it through the stuff, and then an opportune moment during a rehearsal I was like, do you want to try this Slinky sound then? And you all did the same thing, like yeah. So I plugged it in, I turned it on, I gave it a first whack, and it just kind of went dink. I don't even know if it did that. It just didn't really do what I wanted it to do at all. But I had it all rigged up, didn't I? So we sort of stuck with it for a while.
Yeah.
I think just looked good. And you thought it was funny. And I I was getting a bit upset with it, to be honest. and after a while, we ditched it. But yeah.
Stupid. Brilliant.
Very good. Right. Well, very I think good. We're probably... So let's
you don't
just
want to egg this thing, do we?
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure
thanks,
to talk
Tom.
To you.
I'm glad to have a chat, a revisit down memory lane on that stuff because I've, you know, it's a long time ago. Yeah, a great time.
Great.
Great time, great guys.
Great time, great guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great.
Right, I'm going to stop recording now.
Oh, that was good. I like Tom.
Oh, yeah.
He's so brilliant. Man. He was such a lovely man to have around.
Yeah.
And he's like a little slice of home when we went away on tour, wasn't he? It was like, oh, it's like we brought our favourite socks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As I said in the interview, we shared a flat. Actually, I don't know if I might have cut that out of the interview. But
say it now.
I'll say it now. We shared a digs, and he's got some terrible habits.
What?
Oh, terrible. No, I'm joking. He's an exceptionally good cook. And I would say about Tom, he's very clean and tidy.
Is he?
Yeah, he's always kind of... He always tidies up after himself, which is good in a flatmate, I think.
Definitely.
You know, he'd always be sort of washing up and
that. Yeah. Hi, Tom, if you're listening.
Yeah, he probably isn't. To be probably fair, he admitted that he'd never listened to one of these.
No, so, yeah. No, yeah. He did. He did mention the song Victor, didn't he?
He definitely mentioned the song Victor.
Yeah, he mentioned it being a funky one. So maybe we should play that.
Maybe we should.
All right, here is Victor.
Oh,
Kiki D. Kiki D. The Guile of Che Guevara, the pluck of Malcolm X. His parents filled with beaming pride, their every wish was satisfied. They gazed upon him misty-eyed, happy they'd had sex.
They had sex.
It was amazing at Yahtzee, and he played a mean game of chess. So they gave him a name that was synonymous with success. They called him
Victor.
That boy is fabulous.
Victor.
He's never fabulous.
Victor.
Don't call him fabulous. He's the best. You pass the test. You'll be impressed. You'll become obsessed by his hairy chest. He looks good undressed. And if you haven't guessed, I'm talking about me.
Yeah, well, it's a little tidbit for any Living Spit fans out there.
Yeah.
If you saw the Elizabeth, the first show, there's a song right at the beginning, the very first song, in fact, and we got Tom to play the trumpet on that, didn't we?
We did. I tried to do the harmony unsuccessfully.
Oh, nice. That was a good try. But yeah, that was Tom. So we already had him involved in a show in a way, so we thought, well, get him involved in this
one
as well.
And in a way, we did.
And in a way... they did.
So that was Tom as well. A little bit of fan...
trivia. Fan trivia.
Bit of fan trivia.
Bit of fan trivia, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did Tom play on the War in 15 Minutes?
No.
No, he didn't play on that one.
That was Fluff, wasn't it?
That was Fluff and Benji. And Benji Bauer and Will Bauer played on. And Elizabeth Westcott played on that.
Yes.
Those were the musicians we were around at the time, so we grabbed them. But we didn't, completely unpaid. Completely unpaid, yeah, and we're still making money out of that today.
So,
but we're not actually, aren't we? We're not. But on that note, if you'd like to own a copy of... Thanks, a little segue. If you'd like to own your own copy of Living Spit's greatest spits, including 23.
There's a hidden track.
There's a hidden track.
Which definitely isn't because we forgot to put it on the back.
We didn't know it was hidden, but it is. if you'd like to own that, you can. It's 23 of our favourite songs from all of our shows. I think there's one from almost every show on that.
Yes, there is. Yeah, well, apart from the more recent ones.
Yes, the more recent one, OBS. You can get it from our website on digital download or audio CD for the bargain price, Howard, of...
£10.
£10?
£10 for 23.
So I'll take six. No, I won't.
We have actually had a couple of orders. Merchandise sales, because there is merchandise on the website too.
Right. Yeah.
They went a bit quiet. There was a big flurry of activity when we first put them up.
Yep.
But we've actually sold this week a CD.
Have we?
And two tote bags.
Whoa!
I know. So if you did want some Living Spit merch, I mean, there's not that much left. There's pencils. No. We got pencils. We got some
badges have been taken
badges,
off sale.
Well, they're water
some rust
damaged
issues. Yes.
I mean, you know, if you buy anything else, maybe we'll throw in a badge.
We'll throw in
for
a rusty badge
a rusty
for you.
Badge.
There you go.
So yes, and there's several different CDs as well as the Greatest Spits.
Yeah, check it out. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Frankenstein.
Yeah.
We're still planning on sort of doing it this year, if all going well.
We're planning on doing the show again this year.
We would like to.
Yeah, and well, it's still on sale, I think, at the Blake Hay. We'll be doing it. If it's open and we can do it, then we'll be doing
it. If we're allowed to do it, we will be there.
So we should, you know, hopefully this year we'll be doing it at the Blake Hay and at the Tobacco Factory and in Sturmester Newton. However, that's all kind of, you know, COVID-dependent.
Yeah. We will see.
But it's going to be a slightly different version.
Because we've not got the band, obviously, this time round. Couldn't afford them, if you're asking.
Not because they were particularly expensive.
No, they're not expensive. We just can't afford. We can't afford anyone at the moment. So we've reimagined the show as a two-person show. So it'll be Howard and I playing all the parts, playing all the instruments, and all the music is kind of, we've pre-recorded it. So it's going to be quite a new version, which I'm looking forward to, actually, because it was quite a grueling show, wasn't it last time?
Yeah, we've had a little go at the script as well.
But we changed some of the keys of the higher songs.
There were times when both of us,
Howard and I, lost our voices and were ill at the same time, just from being so run down of doing it every night.
It was the most grueling show we've ever done.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Because it was long, for a start. It was a good 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some of those songs were really, like, big sings.
Big numbers,
you know.
Yeah.
Like Victor was for me, and I'm Running was a massive song.
Yeah.
The last song is a kind of just when you think it can't get any worse,
you
have to sing that bloody
just
song.
When you're winding down, you have to do the most energetic song in the whole show.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've had a go at those. We've made them a bit less grueling, and hopefully they'll be just as appealing.
Yeah.
That's the hope.
So hopefully we'll be doing it later on in the year. But if not, we'll almost certainly be doing it next year, won't we?
Yes, we will. But we'll be very sad to say goodbye to Bex and Lauren and Mike and Tom, won't we? Because they were such a brilliant... And Amber and Sam
Amber
as well.
Amber and Sam. Yeah. And
everyone. Yeah. I just missed them all.
I know. So, Pip Naylor, you were talking about chucking some money our way.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got a spare, I don't know, 150 grand, we'll make a show with those people again.
Sure. So, and it can be a show of your choice.
Yeah.
Not Howard's End the Musical,
no.
though.
Anything other than Howard's End the Musical.
Yeah, we'll do it. There you go. You heard it here first, folks. All right, so that's kind of it for Frankenstein.
I reckon it is.
Yeah, we've done three parts on that.
And we haven't decided what we're going to do next, have we?
No, we haven't. We've got like three shows left, I think.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait and see. We'll decide it this week. Craig, do you want to come back or are you going to stay at home this time?
Depends if I've finished my painting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. You've got to do your painting, haven't you?
The trouble is, if you come back, which I would love... It feels like this is a little bit less special, doesn't it? I'll tell you what,
don't come back next week or the week after, but come back for the last one.
Okay.
Whatever it would be.
Well, you say last one.
No, it's not the last one.
The last
one of us talking about shows.
Yeah.
That'd be lovely. Thank you.
Okay.
We'd love to have you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. That's Frankenstein all wrapped up in a neat little bow. So let's go to some
questions from the audience.
And now for some audience questions.
I've written in the running list here, Emotional Stew, he's here for you. No takers, so no jingle. However, I hear from a very reliable source that flowered cock rings might have a little problem for Stew later on, so I'll hold fire on that. I'll start with one from Sue Mercer. Hi, Sue, again. This is a bizarre question. I don't know what it refers to, but she says, I've got a leg question for Stew. Would you recommend a razor in the shower for hair removal or one of the more costly methods on the market? Many thanks. Kiss, 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 kiss. Sue, I don't know what you've heard about me. Have you got any idea what she's referring to?
No, no idea at all. I think she probably meant this to be an Emotional Stew thing, but it's not really very... It's more practical than emotional.
Yeah,
that I'm dissing it, Sue. It's a perfectly reasonable question.
Yeah, and if you want my answer, Sue, IMAC...
Is it not called that anymore?
What's it called?
It's called Veet.
Oh, Veet. Yeah. God, I'm showing me age now. Yeah. Oil of Ule and Imac. And whack some Jif on there as well. And have it with a marathon bar. There you go. Or some opal fruits. So there you go, Sue. I have no idea. I mean, I did have to shave my legs briefly in 2008 when I was in that BBC Three sitcom, Clone, because Clone, the character I was playing, had to have no hair on his body whatsoever. Ooh. And so the producer said to me, can you shave your chest and your arms, even forearm, and leg hair?
You've got forearms?
Yeah, I've got forearms, yeah. I keep two of them behind my back at all times, so I look
good,
normal.
Good idea, that'd be weird.
They said, can you shave all your hair off? So I did used to shave my legs with a razor. Maybe Sue's heard about that. But I did used to use it in the shower, just a razor, Sue. Just your commoner garden razor in the shower. There you go. Enjoy.
Great. Do you want to do the next one?
Okay, I've got one from Prue de Gocklin. Hi, Prue. Been a couple of weeks since we've heard from you, Prue. She says, hi, guys. Loving the podcast. Who's your favourite member of New Kids on the Block? Wow.
There's a problem here.
Go on.
I don't think I could name a member of...
Really?
Is Mark Wahlberg in New Kids?
No, his brother.
No, his brother, Donnie.
Donnie, what, the him then.
He's your favourite.
Literally the only one I know.
And he went off and did an acting career as well. He was in The Sixth Sense.
Was he?
Very briefly at the beginning.
My favourite one is Joey Mack.
Right.
You like
You've
Joey
looked
Mack.
This up, haven't you?
Joey Mack, because all the others were like 15, 16.
Yeah.
And they all knew each other. Joey Mack looks about 9.
Does he?
In a couple of their videos, he's like 9. He's like they're babysitting
him.
He's
the fresh-faced young one, isn't he?
And he was the new kid in New Kids on the Block, quite literally.
Wow.
So I always felt a bit sorry for him.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I couldn't name very unremarkable songs. I mean, I love pop music.
Hanging Tough.
Hanging Tough, yeah.
Hanging Tough.
It was kind of okay.
And my favourite, if you're asking, and you seem to be, Prue, Jordan Knight. There you go. Howard, you got a question?
Well, I've got a question from Flowered Cockrings.
Oh, no.
And this is actually an Emotional Stew question.
Right.
So maybe you want to play in the jingle.
I'll play in the brand new jingle.
Emotional Stew, he's here for you.
There you go, Flowered. That jingle just for you. Right, let's hear it then. I'm going to go into Emotional Stew mode. Go on, Flowered.
I regularly listen to a podcast done by these two blokes who run a theatre company out of a small town in Somerset.
Yep.
I've seen all of their shows and they're really funny, especially the fat one. He's just so cuddly. I can't stop thinking about him. Sometimes I look at pictures of him and touch myself.
Oh, dear.
I think I'm falling in love with him. I've tried to communicate this to him via a series of questions to the podcast, but I've got the feeling he's getting a bit irritated and I think my love might be unrequited. What can I do?
Well, Flowered, unrequited love is one of those things in life that's so hard to deal with, and there's not really a right or wrong way. You just need to follow your heart and listen to what your heart's telling you. But, Flowered, there is no point running after something you're never going to get. So that's the first step towards your recovery, is accepting that the fat one in this podcast that you don't mention the name of is never going to be yours. He's taken, he's married, he's got a child, Flowered. Think about that. If you got with him, you'd be breaking up a family. So, Flowered, move on. Find somebody else. Maybe look at the back catalogue of New Kids on the Block and check out Joey Mack. He's a fresh-faced one from New Kids on the Block. Or a more modern interest. I don't know, gardening. Something to take your mind off the fact, Flowered, that he will never be yours. I'm sorry, it's a harsh truth, Flowered, but you need to hear it. Thank you.
Wow, that was just... You know Denise died on This Morning?
Yeah.
Have you thought about applying to fill the...
I could do it with a kind of Geordie accent.
Yeah, could you... If there's any more, right, next week...
You need to move on, Pat.
Next week, I want you to do it with a Geordie accent, because that would be very funny.
There won't be any more, but I might.
There might be.
There might be.
Does that mean the jingle will change then, if it's...
No.
No, it's going to stay the same.
Okay.
But, the jingle probably won't be appearing next week because no one's going to come in with one.
Oh, I've got a feeling they might.
Yeah, but if it's Flowered cock rings again, I've answered the problem now.
Her?
Yeah, is it not her?
No, I think it's a man.
Oh, I'm sorry, Flowered.
Flowered's a guy.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Craig, you've got a question.
Oh, yeah, I have got I've got a letter from Cher.
What?
Wow.
The Cher.
I know. This is... Wow. Hi, guys.
Whoa.
As a regular listener to your podcast... Oh, my God. This is... You can imagine my surprise when my name was mentioned last week. Oh, what a thrill. What a thrill for us as well, Cher.
Definitely Cher.
Oh, my God. This is amazing. Thank you, Stu, for thinking of me as a fantasy dinner party guest. And also for your kind appreciation of my Golden Globe Award-nominated performance in the 1985 film Mask. Although I didn't win the Golden Globe Award that year, it was Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh.
I did receive Best Actress at the Cannes Film Festival. Did Whoopi? No.
No.
Anyway, my question to you is, what awards have you won?
Wow,
that's
a brilliant letter from Cher and a great question. Thank you so much, Cher.
It's definitely real, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
It says from Cher.
So yeah. I love Cher even more now.
Oh, so, yeah, awards. Well, we've been nominated for an award, haven't we?
We have been nominated for an award, quite excitedly.
We have been nominated for
an award. Collectively.
We were nominated for the Off West End Award.
And what's brilliant about it is this. Dear listener.
Yeah.
It's brilliant, but also a bit selfish, but go on. But it is brilliant.
What's brilliant about it is that they nominate all throughout the year.
Yeah.
And we got nominated in February.
Yeah. Just before
Before the lockdown. So there's no theatre going on at the moment, which greatly increases our chances of being on the shortlist.
We're in with a shout.
Yeah. But what's the category we've been nominated in?
Oh, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
Best Ensemble. There's only two of us in it. We only qualify as an ensemble by one.
Yeah, by one.
Not that we're ungrateful.
No, we're very, very grateful. Yeah. And it was a real lovely bit of news when we were in London to get that nomination. So thank you so much. Well, hopefully we'll win.
It'll be a Pyrrhic victory, though, if we do.
Yeah.
Have you ever actually won an award, Stu?
I have.
Have you?
I won the Carlton Hobbs Radio Bursary Award.
You did?
In 2004, straight from drama school, which meant I did 6 months with the BBC Radio Drama Company.
Except you didn't do 6 months, did you?
No, I didn't do 6 months because I left early. But I then went back in 2011 and did 6 months then. So all was forgiven, and I was rehired. Oh. But I'd love to go back one day, maybe. But it was lots of fun, because I got to do lots of radio drama. So if you're listening to Radio 4 Extra one time, the chances are you might hear me in one of those radio plays. What about you, Craig? What have you won?
Awards. We did a show called Tea and Anogue, or Into the West. It was a play about an Irish traveller family living in Dublin. And we took it to the Dublin Festival.
Oh, wow.
And we were all English. It was three of us. in the cast and two musicians, all of us English, all of us doing our best kind of Irish accents in
You're
Dublin.
Brilliant at accents as well.
I'm brilliant at accents, as you know. And we were in Dublin at the Dublin Festival, and we won the Samuel Beckett Award.
What?
My God.
For best piece of children's theatre.
Wow. And Samuel Beckett was well known for his children's theatre, wasn't he? What a strange sponsor of the award.
Imagine Samuel Beckett's version of the Gruffalo. It would go on for about 6 hours, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Come here while I embrace you. And the Gruffalo hugs a mouse for 6 minutes.
When's the Gruffalo coming?
I can't go on. I'll go on. I can't go on. I'd go on.
And then the Gruffalo would come on in the middle of the show and do a really long monologue about
a six-page monologue. Nothing at all. And then leave the stage.
What we're doing there, listeners, is we're demonstrating our knowledge of the Samuel Beckett play Waiting for Godot.
Yes. Yeah, and we haven't demonstrated much knowledge of children's literature. We know the Gruffalo, and that's it.
Yeah.
Although my daughter's been... She's obsessed with this new book. It's the best book ever. It's called Mucky Duck.
Oh, lovely.
Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's brilliant. And she does this thing, when you finish reading it, she goes, eh? Which means, can you read it again, please? And it's just about a duck that lives with a little boy and just keeps getting messy.
Right.
Like, does cooking and gets covered in flour and stuff. And it goes, oh, you mucky duck. And she loves it.
The world of the one-year-old book is yeah. There's
brilliant.
One where a mole goes around with a turd on its head.
Oh, yes.
The whole book.
Yeah.
And basically try to find out who has shat on its head.
What's it called? I'm writing it down.
I can't remember. Look it up on the internet. It's brilliant. It basically goes up to all the other animals and say, did you poo on my head? And all the animals go, no, because my poo looks like this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's just brilliant. It's
scatological education.
Yeah.
I love it.
Or scatucation.
Scatucation. I love it. I'm going to definitely get that book for her. Well, there we go. There are awards.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you won an award?
Nobody's
Howard?
Ever won, asked me. No, have you? Never won an award. We won an award for a show I did, Beasts and Beauties.
Oh, yes.
At the Slow Vic.
What was that?
We won. It was a very short-lived award. It was, I think, maybe the only year that it happened. It was Venue, the magazine in Bristol, used to do, did an award, you know, 1 year, and we won the best theatre show, I think.
Wow.
And I got to collect the award.
Did you? You get your tux on and go up?
No, it was literally, there was no ceremony. I literally...
You drove round and got it from...
No, they kind of took a picture. They came to the Slovak, took a picture, and then... I have actually, though, and this is probably more exciting, I have actually been the presenter of an award, the special guest.
That's right.
In an award ceremony a few years ago. The local amateur theatre awards, the Rose Bowl. I say local, it's regional, I think. It's a big old deal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That it culminates in a massive proper award ceremony. At the time it was at the Winter Gardens in Weston-super-Mare. I don't know if it's there now. But anyway, and it was all proper. It was like kind of, I had to wear a tux and do a little skit and stuff. And I mean, I think they only booked me because Chris Harris wasn't available.
Right. And you two together hosted a gala evening of award, didn't you, at the Bristol Old Vic?
It wasn't an award ceremony.
Oh, it wasn't?
But it was a fundraiser, wasn't it? That was terrifying. Do you remember that?
It was absolutely terrifying.
I was on holiday in Prague and you two said, well, we'll do it together.
Yeah. Well, the sort of idea originally was that Stu and I were going to do it.
Oh, was it?
And Craig was going to direct it, I think. Because Toby Hulse had written the script. And in the end, it ended up being me and Craig doing it and Toby directing it. And for those who don't know him, Toby's a brilliant director and writer.
We've mentioned him a couple of times, actually, Toby, haven't we, on this podcast? Yeah. We've never talked about who
Maybe
he is.
Maybe we should get him in. Chat about his work.
Now, that'd be nice.
That'd be interesting.
There we go.
Maybe we do that.
The next episode after the three.
Maybe we could get people in to talk about...
That'd be good.
People
Interview.
That we like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trouble is, I don't like many other people.
No, that's true.
I like Toby.
Yeah. There'll be
and
a
you
few.
Two.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it, really. anyway.
So, it was terrifying, wasn't it? They'd got all these special guests in, hadn't they? And they were like the real deal, you know. It was a proper fundraiser. It was kind of...
It was people like Prunella Scales and Timothy West.
I mean,
people with actors or celebrities with an association with the Bristol Old Vic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this long-running gag
that
we were going to get Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes.
Because obviously he went to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. And that he was going to turn up.
Yeah.
But he was such a chameleon actor.
That's right.
That whenever he came on, he looked like somebody else.
Yeah, that's right.
Which, of course, he did, because we couldn't get Dan and Day Lewis to come.
Yeah, I remember the best one, of course, is Patrick Mallard.
Patrick Mallard.
So we had this, we were the linking between them doing a turn.
Right.
And Patrick Mallard quite rightly had said, look, I don't want to interact with them because he didn't have time for rehearsals and stuff. It's a completely reasonable thing to do. He says, I've got a thing I can do. So if you get them to introduce me and, you know, send me off, then that'll be great, which is absolutely fine. But we wrote in the script. Well, did Toby write in the script? I can't. It got developed anyway that Patrick Mallard, we were going to pretend that you'd forgotten to introduce Patrick Mallard.
Well, yeah, we'd done a sketch about comedy policemen. And because Patrick Mallard had played policemen on stage, and at the time I think he was doing Game of Thrones, wasn't
he? Yeah.
So he was like a famous actor who'd done detective kind of acting. So we'd done this scene where Howard and I were comedy policemen. And at the end of the scene, we'd realised that I shouldn't have played that part. Patrick Mallard should have played that part, and that he was in the wings waiting to come on to play that part, and that he was going to be really, really disappointed.
And we'd rehearsed.
We rehearsed this whole thing. And of course, Patrick Mallard did not know anything about this at all, because he hadn't come to rehearsals, he hadn't got a script, he was just going to turn up.
He's a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah, he was going to turn up and do an anecdote, and that's all he was going to do. So we did this whole thing where Patrick, I was going, oh my God, Patrick Mallard, he was going to play this part, what are we going to do? And you were going, I don't know, you're going to have to go off and tell him that he's not needed anymore. And I was going, I can't do that, it's Patrick Mallard, he's going to kill me. Playing on the expectation that Patrick Mallard is this hard geezer who's a really serious actor. So then I said, okay, so I walk off the stage into the wings and pretend to tell Patrick Mallard that he can't do the script. So I walk off stage, walk into Patrick Mallard, looking at me going, what's going on?
Well, we'd rehearsed it for ages, like, yeah. You'd just gone off. And then all of a sudden, on the day, he was there.
He was there. And then I had to, like, turn around and walk back on stage as if I'd had a conversation with Patrick Mallard and say to Howard, I said to him he could come on and give an anecdote, a little theatrical anecdote.
Stories, yeah.
And when I said that to him, his little face lit up. And I don't think that was scripted. I think I probably
said
that.
Yeah.
And you nearly went then. You nearly
your
went.
Little face lit
and, then, up. And then we went, so ladies and gentlemen, Patrick Mallard.
And then ran away.
And then just ran away, because then he walked on looking very bemused. Yeah. But he did tell the funniest theatrical anecdote ever.
Yeah,
it was a consummate performance.
Yeah, really good. And in some ways, that's the way to do those things. You don't want to be interacting with a load of idiots like us, do you?
No.
There we go.
We've exhausted that.
Wonderful theatrical
anecdotes. So I hope that answered your question, Cher.
Yeah, Cher.
Cher.
There we go, Cher.
And feel free to give a contribution anytime you like, Cher.
Yeah. I've got a question here for Handyman Howard.
If your decorating's driving you insane, and your board cop is just refusing to break, he's here with advice, not for financial gain. It's Handyman Howard.
Okay, so this one comes from top fan David Phillips. He says, Handyman Howard, my wife wants to create a feature wall in the lounge. Should I go for a bold colour or a more subtle shade? Only asking so I have someone to blame if she doesn't like it.
Great. Well, it's interesting, David. It's an interesting question, I think. I mean, the concept of a feature wall does really imply something that is in contrast to what's around it. I mean, a feature wall is... I'm quite keen of a feature chimney breast. I don't know if you have a chimney breast in your house. Lots of modern dwellings don't have them. You know, anything after the sort of 40s or 50s, you won't have a chimney breast, so you won't be able to do this. But I do like a chimney breast. I would go for a contrasting shade, but I would make sure that not only is a feature wall, that it's an interest wall too. So my friend and colleague Stu McLaughlin has a great feature wall in his house, and it's not a huge house, but it's really stylish. He's got a very dark wall, which you'd think on paper you think dark wall, but actually what he's cleverly done, I think, is covered it in interesting pictures that mean something to him, which and his wife Megan and possibly their daughter Laurie. And I think that, for me, that really works. So a feature wall, but also an interest wall. I also want to take a slight issue with the second part of your question, which is only asking so I have someone to blame if she doesn't like it. Now, I'm slightly concerned about the state of your relationship there, David. This is something that really you need to work with the she, a wife stroke partner. You need to work with her to really... you shouldn't be embarking on anything that you haven't agreed in advance, because that is not the way to create happiness and joy in a household. So I think you need to work together. You need to listen to her. You need to be strong and put your own ideas in as well. But you need to find some kind of compromise. So that's that. And let us know how it goes.
There you go, David. Work harder to achieve handyman happiness there with her indoors.
Slightly also straying into Stu's territory there. I'm here for you.
That's true, actually. It's a bit of a crossover.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, David, get in touch next week with the emotional response to how that went for you, and I'll do my best to clear up the mess. Also, you mentioned my feature wall there. We've got a new one as well now.
Oh, have you? What
is it? In the bathroom, Maggie's done a feature wall in yellow.
Oh, nice.
Which, I've got to admit, I wasn't that keen on when it was on paper. I said, yellow in the bathroom? That's just piss-coloured. And she said, no, it'll work. And she was right. It does. So there
great.
You go. Sometimes
you
should
have
just
you got lots of lovely
a...
pictures on it? Or...
Well, we're not yet, but right. we're going to put a shelf on and some lovely pictures.
Good.
So there we go. We've achieved handyman happiness there.
David, you see that's a textbook example of matrimonial harmony. And
there
I think
go.
You need to take note.
Okay. Well, that's it. We got one more item.
Now, can I just talk about this? Right?
Go on.
Handyman Howard now comes at the end of the questions, and then I have to do Howard's end.
That's a good point. Maybe we should do it before the questions
I reckon
from the audience. All right, next week we'll shuffle it around a bit.
Great, now. Thanks.
And now it's time for Howard's End.
Howard's End is going to end the show for us. Howard's End.
So this week, we've finally reached the end of our show, Frankenstein. We've talked about doing it in the Tropicana in Weston and the travails that presented themselves to us there. We've also heard from David Phillips, who said that even Stu's penis hasn't put him off seeing the show. And I think that's something we can all think about. If you're talking about Stu's penis, remember, be kind.
Wow, you really spun it around to being kind about my penis.
Yeah,
there.
Why not? I thought, because I know you're getting really sick of people talking about your penis, I thought I'd stick it in there.
Well,
if you'll pardon the expression.
Well, yeah. Well, that's very sweet of you. Thank you. Yeah. I do feel better.
Great.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
That was the Living Spit Podcast. Goodbye from the Living Spit Podcast. You've been listening to the Living Spit Podcast. It's gone away.